Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. Next weekend, the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra closes its 2013-14 Masterwork season. A somewhat nostalgic occasion, looking back over the past year, but particularly this time, for those of us who have long held season tickets at Robinson Center Music Hall. Because it will be a farewell to the old hall while it undergoes a massive internal renovation. So the next 2 years will no doubt have more than its fair share of surprises. Right now, though, the program we look forward to not only closes with the Fifth Symphony by Gustav Mahler, but also has the work guest composer Christopher Theofanidis was commissioned to write, chosen by the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra musicians. Its title is The Wind and Pettigene. But first, some of the composer's background. He has been this season Composer of the Year, and several of his works have been heard already over the past few months. He has written an impressive number of compositions for full orchestra, chamber music, ballet, and has two separate commissions for the San Francisco Opera and Houston Grand Opera. Winner of multiple awards, prizes, fellowships, he is a former faculty member of the Peabody Conservatory and the Juilliard School and is currently teaching at Yale University. He was born in Dallas in 1967, his father a pianist.
I started off as a pianist, actually. That was the direction I thought I was going in. And when I was a teenager, I developed a tremor. The doctor basically told me, well, there are two things you can't do in life. One would be a concert pianist, and the other would be a brain surgeon. So I kind of shifted over in music towards something else, and little by little found myself composing.
Well, it's interesting because I've interviewed a couple of pianists, one jazz musician who's coming here at the end of this week, and they started off with composing almost the same time they started breathing, I think. One was one of the finalists in the Kleiburn competition last June, Nikita Mendoyant from Russia, and he said that he composed as much as he ever played. He started playing, I think, when the piano was about the age of four, and he's already sort of up and having recordings and orchestras using some of his works, which is remarkable, I think.
That's right, absolutely. And in fact, it's a very small world because I know Nikita. Not only did I wrote the competition piece this year that all of the semifinalists played in, but he also is the cousin of one of my former students. It is a small world. But in fact, I think that there is a kind of thing that happens simultaneously to a lot of performing musicians and composers, that they may start off composing by improvisation, which was the case for me, and they kind of went hand in hand before, and traditionally they have as well, I mean, going back pre-Bach. The ability to both improvise in the moment and then kind of compose out something go hand in hand, in the sense that when I'm composing something and it's, kind of quite labor-intensive and it takes a while to get things on the page, you still have to have a very strong intuitive sense of whether or not this is actually flowing, which I think is still kind of keeping alive that improvisational sensibility about what you're doing, that you want things to flow in a naturalistic kind of way, and that's very much informed from that tradition.
Does a commission inspire you or constrain you?
No, I always feel like it inspires me. I mean, the neat thing, the thing I've been very interested in doing with this piece has been to find something about Arkansas in particular that really stimulated my imagination that I wouldn't have been able to come up with on my own. And so the story of Pettigene Mountain, the legend behind that was something of great inspiration to me, and I mm-hmm. it was a great launching pad and kind of starting point for the piece. And I was really happy with the way things kind of evolved and developed from that. So the starting point usually is a restriction only of minutes and number of players, and you can write your heart in a solo piano piece or for a piece for 80 musicians. That's always there as a possibility, and part of it is what's behind the music that's inspiring it, not so much the physical constraints or the time constraints.
It sounds as though the imagination triggers the music.
Yes, people find their own way of working. And the thing that I usually do in the very, very beginning is find a kind of poetic impulse behind what I want to do. And I do kind of think dramatically and narratively and kind of in a romantic musical style tradition. And so storytelling is something that I respond very well to. Poetry is another thing that I respond to. It's a kind of launch pad for the piece. And that kind of sets the emotional tenor of the work. But then from there, it has to develop its own kind of logic and its own life. But I would say, you know, for instance, in this piece, I had the image when I was there that kind of the voice of Petit Jean was on the wind. The remnants of her story were still in that place in a way. That image started kind of a very haunting melody that then grew and became the material for the piece. And in fact, in the beginning of the work, you hear it's kind of like a call on the wind. The sound hangs in the silence, and there's the presentation of that melody. But so yes, they do very much start from those places and then kind of develop from there.
So do you, as I would think poets do, have a notebook of melodies and phrases that come and you think, now it's not quite time to put that in here, but I must use it somewhere, and have a little treasure trove of things to go back to?
Yes, particularly from piece to piece. Like for the example, this piece, there were three pieces of material. One was a very strong melody, one was kind of a motivic idea, and one was a sonority. And those three materials I always had in front of me when I was working on the piece, so that I could constantly have them as a frame of reference, always try to return to them, find ways to integrate them, their shapes, the kind of sound world that they're from, continuously in the piece. So I never got too far away from those things.
Yeah.
In the process of that, sometimes other things come up that you like but are not appropriate for that work, and then you do tuck those away.
Yes. Then do certain instruments suddenly present themselves as this is the one that needs to be the voice of this particular movement or this particular theme or, for you, the story of Petit Jean?
Right. It doesn't happen that way every time. But one thing that I find very useful is to do basically a sketch score of the piece before I get to the kind of finer orchestrational points of the work. And what that means is there would be, instead of, you know, the 80 members of the orchestra and the basically 20 or 30 lines of music happening at the same time, there might be four lines happening. And that what that allows is to maintain a bigger sense of the structure and the flow, and then you can go back and orchestrate that out quite a bit in more detail. And that kind of short score is really useful because it gives you the most flexibility to imagine things from a standpoint of seeing the whole picture of the form.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, music is so elastic when you think about sound. I mean, any melody can be presented in a million different ways, and it's partly has to do with what's the appropriate character, you know, what is the inventiveness of the moment, how does it serve the structure to orchestrate things a certain way. And those things all come into play for me when I know the bigger shape of the piece.
And in music, there are so many phrases and idioms, things like a ground bass that you suddenly feel you have to put something in as a voice that is there but hardly noticed until it becomes more obvious. And I wondered if you fell back on some of those well-worn but always new, considering the quality and inspiration of the composer, that even though you might not have thought you'd have a need for a certain way of treating a phrase or using the instruments, you suddenly realize that you are falling back upon some tried and true, but it sounds fresh because it's yours and new.
Yes, very much. And I think that the best thing somebody who's artistically inclined can do for themselves is to absorb as many of those things and let them be part of your consciousness so that they come out in the right moments and they're available and accessible to you and occur to you in the moments that you're writing. The interesting thing is when you do something like that, when you do a ground bass or a fugue or something like that, you may also be aware of the fact that this is a very old, worn, well-worn convention that you want to breathe some life into. And so part of the joy in kind of engaging those things is trying to figure out a way to kind of make them your own and not let them become an academic presentation.
Yes, something like a theory exercise in second-year
right.
theory.
Right, exactly, yes.
But again, every voice in the orchestra is different, and you must at times know instinctively which phrases are going to use the woodwinds or the brass or the timpani or whatever is coloring the mood and the temperament of that particular part of the work. Do you have a clue beforehand when you're writing this short version, which instruments to put in which part of which movement?
Very much so. I mean, generally speaking, and sometimes it's quite specific, and I allow myself in those moments to really write down what I feel like I want to write down in terms of the orchestral color. You know, the opening of the piece, for example, is a very simple melody. I wanted it to be very breathy sounding, so there are three flutes playing it with string, with the violins, and I wanted to have a sense of the sound hanging in the air. So there's, after the melodic instruments finish playing, what's left is the resonance of the piano and the vibraphones kind of hanging in the air with those same notes, but not really present in the way that a sustaining instrument would be. So that's the kind of thing that gets, I had a very strong concept of the way that should sound. In that short score, I did write that out quite, you know, part of it, the joy of afterwards considering what you're doing is also figuring out interesting blends. You know, I remember somebody describing French wine, for example, as having all of these things that happened, you know, the bouquet, the kind of the way things kind of evolve in the taste. And that's also part of the joy of orchestration, is finding these very unusual combinations and blends of things that create a kind of a particular sound world or a particular presentation of the material. You know, it's, for me, it's also one of the joys of listening to music is being aware of that level of sound care that somebody's taking with the presentation of material. I mean, the sensual quality of the sound is very much part of my listening experience, and it's not just harmony and melody and so forth.
Also, probably a matter of discovery. You suddenly may have been thinking of one particular part of the work, some particular phrase that doesn't quite hit the point you want it to. And then it comes to you, and it's like a dam released.
You feel like you're balancing your joy for appreciating other things and then wanting to let it kind of be part of your psyche so that it comes out in creative ways of its own, your music. The piece is called The Wind in Petitjean, so it's literally from that. You know, the legend of Petitjean has a couple of different incarnations and forms, but this particular, my experience there in particular, it felt like the right title.
You mentioned piano.
I use it a lot for the sustaining quality. You know, if it doubles something and then you, with the pedal sustains, it's quite an amazing resonance.
And has something that no other instrument in the orchestra would have.
That's right.
But it sounds as though you've never stopped thinking of music and how it can express things so magnificently well.
Well, thank you. Yes, I try to do that. And, you know, it has to mean something to you first in order for you to want to put it out there. But I find a lot of inspiration in different kinds of things, and hopefully that comes out well.
That was Christopher Theofanidis, the Arkansas Symphony's Composer of the Year, whose work, The Wind and Petitjean, commissioned by members of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, receives its world premiere this coming weekend, April 12th and 13th. The concert program, the final of the 13-14 season, includes Symphony No. 5 by Gustav Mahler. 8 o'clock Saturday, April the 12th, and 3 p.m. Sunday in Robinson Center Music Hall. Students kindergarten through 18, accompanied by a ticketed adult, can enter free. For tickets, call 501-666-1761 or online arkansassymphony.org.
Here's a look at what's happening in the arts in Arkansas. Today is the final day for Les Miserables at the Arkansas Rep. Two shows, one at 2 p.m. and one at 7 p.m. It's also the final day for Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Wizard of Oz at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Final performance is at 2 p.m. This afternoon at UALR, Artsbury presents jazz saxophonist Steve Owen performing with current and former UALR faculty at 3 p.m. Owen also performs with the UALR Jazz Ensemble at 7:30 tomorrow night. Both performances are at UALR's Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall. At the Pocket Community Theater in Hot Springs this afternoon, Over the River and Through the Woods at 2:30. Shows continue next weekend with performances at 7:30 on Friday and Saturday and a final matinee on Sunday. This evening at 6, Trinity presents a collegiate performance showcase at Trinity United Methodist Church on North Mississippi. At the Arkansas Arts Center this week, the Rocktown Poetry Slam is Wednesday at 7 p.m., and Art of Motion Tango Lessons is at 7 on Thursday night. Thursday at Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas native Trenton Lee Stewart, author of The Mysterious Benedict Society, will speak 7:30 p.m. in Reeves Recital Hall. This Thursday and Friday at UCA in Conway, A Doll's House, performances at 7:30 each night at Snow Fine Arts Center. Performances continue April 16th through the 18th. Opening Thursday at Ouachita Baptist University in Arkadelphia, Guys and Dolls, with shows Thursday through Saturday at 7:30 and a matinee next Sunday in the Jones Performing Arts Center. At Weekend Theater this Friday and Saturday, Tuesdays with Maury, 7:30 each night, with a special matinee performance next Sunday. Shows continue through April 19th. Friday at the Old State House Museum, join me, Ben Fry, for a screening of White Lightning, the 1973 Burt Reynolds movie shot here in Arkansas. It's part of the Old State House's Lights, Camera, Arkansas exhibit and Second Friday Art Night. Show starts at 5:30. And Saturday at the Eureka Fine Arts Gallery in Eureka Springs, a reception with guest artist Jody Stevenson, 6 to 9 p.m. Her exhibit is on display through April 28th. And that's a look at the arts calendar for this week. For more on what's going on in Arkansas, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org.
Theater Squared, the repertory theater company in Fayetteville, closes its 2013-14 season with Hamlet, which opens April the 10th. Artistic director Bob Ford with managing director Martin Miller joined in heartfelt agreement when I asked if this play, Hamlet, really is, as one constantly hears, the one play that every director and or actor dreams of. Bob Ford.
No question about it. I think it's justifiably, more often than not, called the great play of all time. It's just so emotionally and psychologically complex, and it's just living in a modern age. And yeah, there's no question about it. And there is the excitement in the theater because of that is palpable.
Now, is that why you chose it to be the last one, because it would be very difficult to follow it?
Well, that's one good reason.
I didn't think of that, but now that you mention it.
I think we really just, you know, every year we ask ourselves, should we save something for next year? And then we basically always answer, no, let's blow it out. Let's put in every show we really want to do. And so this last season, when we were planning for this season, we said, okay, for instance, here's these two new great plays we want to do, Good People and 4,000 Miles. Okay, let's add a fifth production so we can do them both. And then, look, no one is really producing Shakespeare at the professional level it deserves to be produced in Northwest Arkansas. So area audiences really just don't have necessarily preformed conceptions about Shakespeare, except maybe that it's not for them, maybe that it's inaccessible. So it seemed like a really great thing to do, to be able to say, listen, no, we're going to do this well, and you're going to come in, and this will form your opinion of going to a live Shakespeare performance done by a professional theater. And so, yeah, I guess it is no understatement to say it was ambitious to say, let's form people's expectations of Shakespeare with our last play this season and then send them into the summer reeling. But yeah, that's kind of what we did.
So my next questions then are relative to this production, or to any production really. Do you choose the director for it first?
Yes. Your mind is already working on casting on all aspects. Mm-hmm, aspects. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, because you want the director to have a voice in all of those aspects, including casting.
Right.
So there are no choices made until the director is on board.
Yes.
Yeah, in theater, a lot of plays are the director's. The director's vision is the forming vision for the play. So you bring the director on first, and they participate in all the casting. They interview every designer. There's no one on the team before they are. So that is very correct. You know, you have to cast Hamlet before you know what kind of play it's going to be. The age of the character, the way they interpret it, just the general feel they bring to the character really defines the production. So it was also, we have to wait to cast anyone else until we know who Hamlet is.
So the director that you pick up first, does he have a say as to who the Hamlet will be?
Absolutely. Because especially in this play, they're going to have such a close relationship in rediscovering that role and all its complexity. There needs to be a really strong personal connection, not necessarily, you know, instant friendship, but just the director needs to feel that I am going to be able to converse with this actor about this role and feel completely comfortable. And we had certainly half a dozen actors that we know and love over the years, and we being, you know, Martin and Amy Herzberg and other members of the company here, certainly presented them all to Sean Patrick Riley. But the decision was ultimately his, in very close consultation with me, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Amy and I and Sean saw all of the auditions for Hamlet. The priority for me was that Sean feel very comfortable ultimately with the selection. We saw eye to eye right down the line. So
how do you know Riley?
Sean came to us through a reading of my play, The Spiritualist, that we did a living room read in Greenwich Village about 2.5 years ago, and we hit it off with him right away.
Yeah. Sean is one of those people who you feel really lucky to have in our circle because he represents a level of professional experience that you almost have to, they can kind of choose their project. The fact that he can choose and does choose us kind of means a lot to us. Now, obviously, as you said, Hamlet is a dream gig for a lot of directors and actors, so he was very excited to work with us on this show, but he's a great case in point of how you form a relationship with an artist and just keep bringing them back in different ways to contribute.
Have you done Hamlet before?
This is the first time we've done Shakespeare on our main stage, and it's
a challenge.
It's been fascinating to sort of step back and watch how this idea has played in all of our minds because of the, on the one hand, it's like it's audacious. You're taking on, you know, the great Shakespeare play as your first Shakespeare. It's audacious to even do Shakespeare on the one hand. On the other hand, we feel fully equipped to bring a, you know, the third sort of theater squared touch to this play. And what I've seen, and now that we're in rehearsal, I realize, oh, yes, this is an absolute natural fit for our theater space physically, for the kind of theater that we are. We kind of grew up as an actor's theater, as much of the impetus to start the company had to do with the love of acting and actors. I dare say it's fitting us like a glove.
We can put together a great team to do a world premiere new play because we know people with those skill sets. We can do the same thing on a production of Shakespeare by bringing in, for instance, our lead actor who plays Hamlet has appeared in 50 Shakespeare productions across the country. He brings a level, a sort of grounding in the text and just the world of Shakespeare's language that is incredibly just a real asset.
Yeah.
And Sean, the director with his background, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and then all of our cast members who are just great actors, as Bob was saying. You know, if you put good actors in the room with some experience with Shakespeare, it's as if you have a depth of institutional knowledge just in the people that you've put into the room.
Right. Now, we get back to your production. The director comes in already with some ideas of what he'd like to do in terms of, A, perhaps relocating it somewhere. That's a temptation a lot of people think when it comes to Shakespeare. How do you, as the company bringing in these various people, handle the ideas that are going to fly around to be picked on?
We started talking in the West Side Cafe on 9th Avenue. Whether that means anything, that Theater Squared is doing Hamlet. In fact, that was when we talked concept with Sean, his concept was, I want this to be Theater Squared's Hamlet. And I knew what he meant immediately. It was intimate, a very non-presentational, much more about the sort of psychological development of the relationships within the play, within the story, and then between, especially Hamlet and the audience, which is 3 feet away as he's speaking to them and bringing them into these soliloquies. Shorter answer is, Sean and I had a conversation that started last August and went all the way through and continues even now.
Mm-hmm.
As we develop it. We did not want to put it in any particular time period. So that in terms of that concept, that aspect of a concept, which is picking a specific time and place, we didn't want to do that. We were very inspired by a Globe Theater production. In fact, we started with the particular cutting of Hamlet that they used in a recent production that toured the UK and also came over here. Also, the kind of approach, sometimes called original practices, that is propounded by Mark Rylance and the Globe Theater, that was an inspiration. And then also, Sean said, make sure, I saw it this Christmas time, two productions in Rept of Twelfth Night and Richard III, and I saw the Twelfth Night, which is fantastic. A certain kind of relationship between the company of actors and the audience and the theater, making sure that this story is well told. That was more the concept than finding a particular time and place. That said, we do have very specific look to the costumes, sort of maybe post-Edwardian, a little bit non-specific, but inspired by that time period.
Part of our inspiration for trying to make it of a specific time, but not of a time period that we could pin down. It was in an era where the court was very important, where this aristocratic order was important, but it's a specific time, but it's not a specific time in our history. So as long as we detail out what it means to be in that time, we will have an accurate world.
So many Shakespeare productions, there are temptations that the directors and people succumb to relocate it, to change the language even. And that bothers me because it makes it look as though people are afraid of Shakespeare and tend to avoid him.
Yes, the language has a real primacy in our production. In fact, Sean, the director at the first rehearsal, said, you don't have to look for your subtext. It's right there in the text. This is not about something, an undercurrent that's in opposition to what you're saying. You are just saying it. You're wearing it on your sleeve. Use the language. If you need an answer, look for that answer in the language. So we have definitely subscribed to that viewpoint that you're saying, that this is a masterwork.
Yeah.
We don't need to fix it.
Martin Miller and Bob Ford, respectively Managing Director and Artistic Director of Theatre Squared. The Northwest Arkansas Repertory Theatre production of Hamlet opens April the 10th in the Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studio Theatre in Fayetteville. Tickets can be reserved by calling 479-443-5600 or by visiting theatre2.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.